Well, that's how the passage ended last week that Nigel spoke from. And it's really important for us as a way into this passage. And it's also important as a pretext for my food and drink jokes I'm going to tell you. You may be concerned to learn that a friend of mine is in hospital having eaten a kilo of daffodil bulbs. It's all right, though. You should be out in the spring. I myself am very concerned about another friend who recently has taken to drinking a very lot of brake fluid. I'm worried it's become an addiction, but he says he can stop at any time. Right, I'll pray for us. Father, as we think now about the freedom and rights we have as your people, teach us also the willingness to give those up for your work, as you yourself gave up so much to reach each one of us. Let your word be our guide. Let your spirit teach us. And let the outcome be more glory for you. Through Jesus. Amen. Amen. So if you do remember what Nigel shared last week, you'll remember that Paul is talking to Christians in Corinth who are asking themselves questions about what they can eat and what they can't. So what happens? A Christian sits down to a table, realizes the meat in front of them has been offered to an idol. Do they have the freedom to eat that meat or not? And some were saying, yes, they have the freedom to eat that meat. But Paul, in response, is saying, well, perhaps you do. Perhaps you know that you have the freedom as a Christian. You know, this meat offered to those idols, it doesn't mean anything to us. It represents nothing. It holds no power over us. And yet, if knowing that puffs you up, if it makes you feel all the stronger for doing that, then be careful, because knowledge does exactly that. It can make us arrogant. By contrast, love will set us looking at the situation differently. Love will make us outward looking. It will make us wary of using that knowledge to rub somebody else's faces in their ignorance. So when we make it difficult for someone else, where is the love in that? Well, in our passage then, what Paul says flows from that, from Paul's willingness to give up his rights. Now, he's going to say, give them up for the weaker brother, but also so that you can get the message out there about Jesus and all kinds of people can hear that message. So the gospel sharing reasons that Paul has. This morning, I'd like to flag up 3 points from the passage. And as it's Christmas, I know you'll permit me a fourth point, which is not directly in the passage. So we're going to see that Paul says, I have got the right. I have the right. Secondly, I put the right to one side. That is, I'm not calling my rights in so that more people can get to know Jesus. And it's as we're looking at that, we're looking at Paul's inclination to put his right to one side. We'll see that he didn't need to invent that. We'll see where he's getting this sacrificing your rights from. And lastly, we'll think about Paul or any Christian person being willing to give up what other people around them are enjoying. Being much like a disciplined athlete that knows what their objective is, being to put certain luxuries, as it were, to one side. So there it is. I've got the right. I've given up the right so more people know Jesus. And it's all worth it because, like a focused, disciplined athlete, I know the prize in store for me. So in the first 14 verses, we learn that Paul has some rights too. You Corinthians, you talk about being free as Christians, while I have that freedom as well. And Paul begins this right thing by pointing out that he also has rights as an apostle. So we've said in previous weeks, haven't we, an apostle, someone with a special commission, a special calling from Jesus. And Paul got his when Jesus came to him after his ascension. I am an apostle that has seen Jesus Christ the Lord. And the proof that I'm an apostle is you lot. There may be people out there, says Paul, who want to say I'm not an apostle, but it'd be a bit rich coming from you lot, because the fact that you're Christians today is due to my apostolic work. You are the fruit of what I did as an apostle. Then from verse 4, Paul gets into what some of those rights are. We apostles have the right to food on our table that comes from our job. And if we have family and dependent family members, then they can subsist. They can be sustained as well by this work. an apostle's wife can expect to be sustained. Jesus' brothers know that, he points out. Cephas, that's Peter to you and me, he knows that. It's entirely correct and appropriate to take sustenance for that kind of work. And it's right that a person's occupation sustains them. Soldiers, verse 7, they don't pay for the right of going to war, do they? Deuteronomy will tell you the same thing. It's not just me, Paul, reasoning with you. God's law saying, in the same way an ox can eat from food it is helping to produce, so can a Christian worker expect to live from that work. What's said in the law, what's said in Deuteronomy, it's about oxen, and it's true, but it's written for humans. And then to nail the argument, verse 14, Paul says, it is the will of Jesus himself. We know, don't we, from Luke 10, Jesus has the 72 there, going to send them out to do their work, and he says, the worker deserves his wages. Christian workers then, Paul is saying, whether they are sowing or reaping, whether they are doing pioneering work, telling people about Jesus for the first time, or if they are growing disciples in an established church, it's right they can expect to be kept from that work. Well, we discussed this at the staff meeting, and Nigel said, well, I'm pleased it's you preaching on this and not me, not to be wanting to put the case for clergy wages, as it were. And then I reminded Nigel that, in fact, he's paid by the church commissioners in London just about whatever else anybody in Knutsford does. So it matters less for him than it does for me. Perhaps I should be more embarrassed in saying it's a right expectation that we're paid working in the church. But for a couple of reasons, I don't find it at all embarrassing. One is that it's plainly the teaching we have here. Sometimes people say, don't they, well, Paul, he made tents. And he did that to support his ministry. So perhaps all church pastors should have a secondary career, and then we get them for free. And some Christian organisations do operate like that. Well, in a minute, we'll look at why Paul was willing to make tents to support his ministry. But whatever else we say about it, in verses 1 to 14, we see that it was an exception. It was a carefully thought through strategic exception from the norm for special circumstances. And therefore, it would be a very odd thing to say, well, we're going to organise our church, we're going to create a rule of the exception. Well, the second reason I don't find it embarrassing to talk about the right of a minister to subsist from what he does is that St. John's Christians are, in any case, very good at looking after their ministers. And I just want to encourage us in that. As ministers at St. John's, I think we are generally supported well in all kinds of ways. Now, if you consider the world church, how difficult it is for most churches in most situations globally to pay their ministers, I would say that relatively for Knutsford, paying the ministers is the easy bit. However, Nigel's expressed to us before, he has vicars in very rich parishes, and they're doing a building project, they're doing just about anything, they can find someone who'll write a check for it. And great, it's good that people are giving in those ways. But sometimes in those same parishes, if you look for support or involvement of any other kind, those people are nowhere to be found. Well, I don't think that's how it is in Knutsford. Many of us are very busy, it's true, and yet the staff at St. John's are well supported by members of the congregation, by people giving us their time and expertise so that we can make gospel ministry happen. I don't mean that we're singularly responsible for it, but that we can, as it were, lead on it. So, we're helped in all sorts of other ways beyond our salaries. Just to give an example, I don't think I'll offend either Chris or Nigel by saying that, like me, they're not very good at DIY. So, if you thought a way to save money would be to have us fix our own homes, I don't think it'd save the church any money, and you'd probably be a minister down at least. There are things that ministers we are not good at, and people here sacrificially give time to supporting us in that. It's not only ministers who benefit. Every Christian at St. John's, I trust, is benefiting from fellowship with one another. But the reason I'm not embarrassed to talk about this is because we, as ministers, are well supported. I think we are obedient in that, And I think we can be encouraged. Now, all that said, we get to the second part of verse 12 and the astonishing idea that Paul, having just said, I have a right to expect A, B, and C, well, in any case, I'm putting those rights to one side. But we did not use the rights, he says. So we did not hinder the gospel. What is he talking about? What kind of hindering could that be from expecting those rights? I don't know if you have an interest, whether it's in politics or boxing, but if it's you have an interest in either, you might have gathered that the Klitschko brothers, so they're the heavyweight champion, at least in one case, world champion heavyweight boxers, have taken interest in politics in the Ukraine. The bright fellas, both these heavyweight boxers, have PhDs, and one is now, I think, would like to be president in the Ukraine. Now, I heard someone talking about him the other day, and they were saying that they trust him for a couple of reasons. One is they believe he's not corrupt. Two, they say Klitschko, this is a Ukrainian person speaking, he has no need of us. So they were contrasting him with professional politicians who they say, they would say that. They would say something which appeals to me because they need me. That politician, how does he make his money? How does he live? How does he subsist? He subsists on the position that I potentially can give him. Klitschko, by contrast, has his money from his boxing. He has the no purchase on me, as it were, and therefore they say we trust Klitschko. Well, we've learned in recent weeks, haven't we, about the great touring philosophers of the ancient world. And they so impressed the Corinthians. Well, Paul, it seems, is worried that he might be confused with that lot. If people hear Paul and they're to understand him, he can't have them thinking, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? I'll bet he's making some money from this, like those others who tour our towns and cities. Paul needs to be different, and he needs to be seen to be different from those others. So in that particular situation in Corinth, Paul was worried that claiming his rights to get material support from gospel work could be a problem. I'm not saying this, says Paul, verse 15, so that now you start giving me my rights. As it happens, it's more important for me to keep the arrangement just as it is. Get this, I'd rather die than allow anyone to deprive me of this boast. But preaching the gospel, verse 16, is not about boasting. So Paul's building to his point now, and his point is that there is something in his spirit forcing him to preach, to tell people about Jesus, so that he can't even hold back from that if he tried. That's what's behind the man Paul and his work that makes him different from these travelling philosophers. Your rights, you get to choose to take them or not. But whether we share our faith, we just don't get to choose on that. Right now, I consider it a reward to be able to preach to you for free, verse 18. What about this next bit, verses 19 to 23? We already had, I've got my rights, we had secondly, but I'm not using them. Now it's, I work for everybody's benefit. I serve all men and women. Paul is everybody's slave. Again, in this bit, we're going to see just what Paul is willing to give up, that he doesn't have to, so that yet more people can come to know God through Jesus. Another news item this week which sparked my interest and got me thinking was the controversy over whether in British universities, Muslim groups hiring the university can, in organising their meeting, insist that men and women sit separately. Now, I'm not going to comment on what the universities should do, but as a Christian, I was reflecting. And particularly for those who, there are Christian individuals, missionaries within the UK, Christian people who dedicate themselves to sharing Jesus with Muslims. So here's a scenario for you. I believe that such a Christian person would not participate in a Muslim act of worship, because if they were to do that, then the gospel has stopped becoming the gospel, isn't it? If Jesus is not getting the glory, then we're not talking about the gospel anymore. But how about a Christian person is invited by a Muslim friend to attend a Muslim social gathering. Would they be able to do that if they knew that in getting there, men and women would be divided? Now, perhaps there's something in us that wants to say, well, our European culture is all about equality. And one of the ways we express that is by sitting with one another, men and women. And for sure, as a Christian, there's no rule that makes me have to sit separately, men and women. The question I had in my mind, though, is would we be willing to give that up, that right, in order to reach a Muslim friend with the gospel? So practically speaking, for me to say to my wife, well, I'm off to a social event with person X, you won't be coming. Or you will be coming, but you'll be sitting over there with the ladies. Perhaps it's more of an issue still for women who perhaps have to sit at the back, get rubbish seats, and all the men are sat at the front. Well, my own view, and it is my view, is that Paul would be willing to do that. And here's why. Paul, you see, he was a Roman citizen, wasn't he? He walked the earth a free man. I'm free, he says in verse 19, but I have made myself a slave to everyone. And why did you do that, Paul? To win as many as possible is his answer. I meet a person, Paul would tell us, and although deep down I know I am free, it's as though I am their servant, to give them opportunity to know Jesus. So we ask Paul, how does that work out? Who are these people who you have to adapt yourself to in order to reach them? It's like this, Paul would say, verse 20 onwards. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. So with Jewish people, Paul doesn't do anything that messes with or gets in the way of them understanding the gospel. He's not going to needlessly antagonize Jewish people about their customs or traditions. He will only offend them in as much as the gospel itself is an offense to people who do not accept their need of Jesus. All those ceremonial laws the Jews had, did Paul have to follow all that? Of course he didn't. He was free from all that. He had the liberty of belonging to God in Jesus, and yet he wasn't going to tread all over people who thought it was important. He tried to fit in so he could win them over. With the Gentiles, verse 21, Paul doesn't put unnecessary stuff in the way of them either. He doesn't want the Gentiles to think that this following Jesus is somehow foreign. He's willing to give up status and rights to become lowly in order to fulfill the mission that Jesus gave him. A thing I'd like to share, especially as we're only a few days from Christmas, is this. Paul didn't have to invent the idea of becoming like the people he was sent to. Paul didn't have to invent becoming a servant so that he could be involved in saving work. He didn't have to invent giving up rights, taking up a cross. In the deepest sense, why is the wonder? What's the wonder of Christmas? Why is the wonder about a grubby stable? Why is there wonder about lots of very earthy and earthly situations in that story? Well, the wonder we are celebrating is that God set his rights to one side, that status, for the purpose of reaching and saving human beings. Last week in this service, John used a Puritan Christmas prayer, and here are some of those words again. Herein is the wonder of wonders. He came below to raise me above, was born like me, that I might become like him. He came, God incarnate, to save me to the uttermost. Hear the words of Paul himself in Philippians 2. He talks about Jesus, and he talks about Jesus' followers, so that's you and that's me, who being very nature God, Jesus, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing, by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even on a cross. I think now we're beginning to understand what makes the man Paul tick, why he was willing to do what he was willing to do. And that's because we're beginning to understand God in Jesus and what he was willing to do to reach us. Nigel challenged us last week, what are we prepared to give up in the mission of God? What is more important to us? Is our reputation the most important thing? Our standing? Our social background? Whatever it is, are we willing to sacrifice it so there are minimum barriers to us reaching people with the good news about Jesus? Right now, for now, this is just a rhetorical question, but a few days are coming, Christmas Day, some of us will be with people that we didn't see in a whole long time, and there could even be a reason why we didn't see them in a whole long time. Imagine if, in us, instead of the first thing they see being our rights, imagine if the thing that they saw was the news, the gospel message. Imagine if there was, we put so little between us and them that what they saw in us was this very message that Paul is so keen to share. I'm not putting obligations on people, Paul would say, unless they are gospel-sharing obligations. And apart from that, I'll do whatever I have to. I'll become whatever I have to in order to spread that message. Lastly, then, let's take a look at this little section, verses 24 to 27. We've already thought about Jesus, the deepest reason for doing what a Christian is called to do, who being in very nature God, yet made himself nothing. What about the day-to-day motivation of Paul? What keeps him going? What keeps Paul saying no to things when he could say yes to those things? Every few years, I think it was every 3 years, in Corinth they had these Isthmian games, they were called. So think athletic games, lots of different disciplines, and so think something like ancient Olympics, but not quite as big. Well, he uses, to make his next point, this picture of an athlete participating in competition. And the people he's writing to will be familiar with these games, of course. In a race, everyone has to run, don't they, he says, but there's only one winner. And so everyone running will have to give a good account of themselves if they're going to be a contender. Well, that's how the Christian life is to be lived. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. An athlete exercises self-control. See, these games, apparently, if you wanted to enter, you'd have to go into 10 months strict training for you to even compete. So, as it were, you had to get yourself in hand. You had to say no to yourself. Cake, I'll pass on that. Lion, I'll pass on that. Paul would see in his life a lot of legitimate pleasures, and he would say no to them anyway. And why would he do that? He'd do it so, metaphorically, he could run and then win. What would he win? Verse 25. The athlete does all that just to get this wreath of stuff that's going to fall apart, a prize which degrades. But if athletes do that for that kind of crown, what will we be willing to do for something that does not rust or crumble or rot? With Paul the Apostle, we will want to give the best we can as we're convicted by the Spirit of God in us. It's not merely that we're just trying to stop sinning, not trying to avoid rebellion against God in our lives. It's that we'll be willing to put to one side even legitimate things that get in the way of our walk as disciples. I'm told the Greek in verse 27, what Paul says is literally, I give my body a black eye. I rule my body and it does not rule me, so I can progress in the Christian life. So that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the prize. From time to time, Helen, the church manager, or Chris, the youth minister, they have a clear-up, a tidy-up in the office. They're very house-proud, and each time they do that, it seems a load of old photos come to the surface. And so we've got all these photos knocking around, whether it's in the drop or whether it's in the office. And you see people who would belong to St. John's 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And looking at those photos is good in a number of ways. It's a laugh to see how people dressed then, how they looked then. And it's good to see people from decades ago who are still with us and following Jesus. And it's good to see people who have moved to another area, but we know through communication with them, they're still following Jesus in the places they went to live. What is very sad, though, is to see pictures of people who then appear to be running that race of faith, but today seem to have got lost along the way. And it may even be, like Paul himself seems to fear, there were people who maybe were telling us about Jesus back in the day. Maybe we became a Christian through someone talking about Jesus who today is no longer running the race and perhaps disqualifying themselves from the race and prize. Well, if a thought like that worried Paul, then I think it warrants some thought from us also. Our deepest motivation is the grace that Jesus has shown to us. The reason we'll act in humility and be willing to give up our rights is because Jesus did that first to reach us. But we see here in what Paul's saying, this walk as a Christian implies a certain discipline. Being a disciple implies discipline in that walk with Jesus. Well, to recap and to finish then, I have rights too, says Paul, but I'm willing to give them up so I can tell people about Jesus, and so that how I behave does not get in the way of the gospel message. Also, we saw what we celebrate at Christmas is that God himself in Jesus was the one who lived that out supremely, the sacrificing of rights and power and status. Finally, Paul reminds us that the Christian walk is like being an athlete. A disciplined athlete involves the taking up of the cross. My prayer for us is that in the coming week, as we celebrate what God did in order to reach us, we will sense that same sacrificial inclination welling up inside of us, like Paul talks about. That is the power of Jesus compelling us to share the good news about him, whatever the cost. The gospel trumps my rights. Amen.